My name's Peter Savage. I'm probably best known for my hockey photography. You want to know how I got started in hockey? It's rather interesting, actually, because I used to go to a very, very rough North London school where the sports teacher there was a Welshman and we played rugby. And I was a very skinny 13, 14-year-old and rugby wasn't really my game. But we had some torrential rain over a long period of time and the rugby pitches got waterlogged, and this teacher, looking for something else for us to do, found some shinty sticks in the sports store, and we played shinty on the playground. And I loved it. And a few years later, when I started work, I bumped into a chap called Malcolm Maxwell, who was a forward for Broxbourne, and we had got chatting. At that time, I had a girlfriend who played hockey and used to come watch her play, and he persuaded me to go along to Broxbourne and joined in the training session, and that sort of started it off. And I was hooked on the game, loved it. Never very good at it. I was the first to say that. I'm never very good at it, but I just enjoyed it so much, mainly the company and what have you. And I always saw myself as a flying right winger, but I was fairly hopeless at that. So they put me in goal. We had one more goalkeeper than we needed, so I often found myself umpiring as well. So I sort of became like a goalkeeper come umpire for most of my playing career.
And this was all at Broxbourne?
Originally, yes. And then I moved down to the South Coast and sort of hopped between various clubs. I played for Beckenham for a while and I played a few games for South Saxons. But I joined the police in 1973 and sort of had to give up for a while because of the shifts. But somebody within the police wanted to form a Sussex Police hockey team, and I was one of the founders of that. Organisationally, we were fairly hopeless, and I got a bit frustrated. So I got poached by Brighton and Hove and joined them, and I was chairman there for a time, as well as their fixture secretary.
So how long did you keep playing?
I started playing when I was about 19 and played through to, I think my last game was actually, we had a veterans indoor team at Brighton, which is rather unusual. And because they couldn't find another veteran goalkeeper, I think I was still playing until I was about 43 in goal. But by that time, I was umpiring more and more. So I was virtually a full-time umpire by that stage.
How did you get into the photography side?
Well, that's interesting, because it's always been sort of like a sort of peripheral hobby of mine. And I think it was 1995 when Peter Luck invited me to make a monthly contribution to a hockey sport magazine. And I found myself getting very frustrated that I'd never seemed to be able to find the illustrations that would actually go with what I was trying to describe in my articles. So I got my camera out and started taking my own photographs. And it sort of blossomed from there, really, because it as time went on, I started to realise that people were more interested in what I was photographing than what I was writing. So that's how it originally started. Yeah, and over the years, having started with a fairly basic camera, I actually moved up to the stage where I was using some pretty expensive and sophisticated kit, probably on a par with most professional photographers.
And when did people start buying your photos or commissioning you to take them?
Well, strangely enough, before they had a contracted photographer at England Hockey, England Hockey used to take a lot of my stuff, but they eventually, to the disappointment of a lot of photographers, they decided to have a contracted photographer, A.D. Carey. And I have to say, A.D. is an excellent photographer. I've got no problem with that. It's just it's a sort of cut-off source of income. But subsequent to that, I've had work from the European Hockey Federation and various magazines. So it's gone reasonably well.
As well as taking photographs, you were still writing.
Yeah.
And what sort of output did you write for?
Well, it started off with a monthly column for Hockey Sport. Originally, it was meant to be about umpiring, but I actually found that a bit constrictive because although I was an umpire, it's very difficult to actually churn out something every month about umpiring when there's other things going on in the sport that you'd like to include. And after a time, I think Peter actually gave me a little bit more leeway to write about other stuff. When Hockey Sport stopped publication, England Hockey News used to take some stuff from me. I used to write a fairly regular column called Clubs in Europe, because I used to follow the Euro Hockey League and things like that and go over there regularly. So they they used to take stuff from me on that. And then when Push came along, I also wrote a monthly column for them as well.
What was your most exciting photograph?
Most exciting. Well, I've got I can't give you one, but I can give you three.
That's right.
Right. Clearly, I think when England won the European Championships in 2009, I think it's the team celebrating in the middle of the pitch, which is quite stunning, and it's actually on the wall of my living room back there. But that was one. Then I think, and this is one that is of particular interest to me at the moment, Alex Danson with her bronze medal at the end of the Olympic Games. Because that actually was quite a challenging photograph to take, because it was a very noisy stadium, and I needed to attract the attention of a player with a medal to come over to the photographer's pen. And I thought, whose name can I shout loudest? And I thought, Alex. So I chose Alex, and Alex being Alex, who was very, very obliging, she came over, a big smile, held her medal up, and that was on the front cover of Push, in the Olympic edition. Then, strange enough, not a particularly good photograph, but it's got lots of compliments. England played Germany in the European Championships in Boom I can't remember the year now, but it's the one before last. And there was a shootout between England and Germany at the end, which the Germans won. And at the time, it was tipping down with rain. It was absolutely appalling weather. And I just happened to shoot the German goalkeeper as he was running towards one of her teammates to congratulate each other on winning it, and it's a cracking picture. It's technically not particular, it's a bit out of focus and a bit, you know, there's lots of rain and mist in it, but it just captures the moment, and I've had lots of compliments about that picture, so I'm quite pleased with it. So they would be my three. You could choose which one you like from the three.
Presumably a lot of hockey photography is about being able to capture the moment.
Absolutely. I was once told, because one of the things I haven't mentioned is I actually did some freelancing for Radio Sussex once, and I was told by one of their reporters a little story about somebody who was on holiday in the Himalayas and found that Sherpa Tenzing was on his last legs somewhere or other, and they wanted an interview with him, and they took a dictaphone. It was the only thing they could find. And sometimes the actual quality of what you're doing is not near as important as actually what you're capturing. And that's an interesting lesson to learn, because I said sometimes the best photographs are not necessarily the ones that are technically perfect. Classic example is when Ashley Jackson scored the winner in the European Championships in Amsterdam in 2009. It's not a particularly good photograph, but I was the only person that got it. I've counted my friend, 27 photographers down the end that England were defending and one down the end that the Dutch were defending, and I was the one.
How important was it to your being able to capture these moments, the fact that you played the game?
Oh, I think so. It's quite interesting. I spoke about Adi earlier on. Adi has never played hockey, but he's a superb photographer. But I think sometimes you need a... It's not so much the photograph, it's a selection of photographs that you use, because I think players are looking for something quite different. I'll give you an example. Fleet Street seemed to like photographs taken from the stands downwards at players. And if you look at newspapers, that's quite a common thing. I don't think people who play hockey want to see that. I think they want to see something a little bit more close up and intimate. So I tend to take photographs from low down by the side of the pitch, where you can actually see the player's stick and what they're doing, where the ball is and the look on their face and everything else. So, you know, it's a different approach, I think.
But being able to read the game and predict what's going to happen.
Mind you, hockey is a very difficult game. I mean, I've shot other sports, and I can tell you that hockey is a real challenge because it's speed and the unpredictability of what's going to happen. I mean, I did some horse racing a few months ago, and you know the horses are where you expect them to be at the right time, and so it's relatively easy. But hockey is not, so there's an element of luck in there sometimes.
What other sports have you photographed?
Oh, crikey, athletics, cricket, caught me up there. Athletics, cricket, horse racing, table tennis, one or two others.
Oh, sorry, cricket must pose the same sort of challenges.
Yeah, but. It's funny, actually, because I was talking to somebody whose photograph I'd taken playing cricket only a few days ago, and they were complimenting me on the fact you could see the seam on the ball as they go to hit the ball. But you know where the ball's going to be, more or less. So, and it's only going, most of the time, forward-ish.
Yes.
You don't get people sort of flick it behind them, well, not deliberately anyway, but hockey is difficult.
Yes. Presumably most of the photographers are specialist hockey photographers, aren't they?
Yeah, if you go to... they tend to come in sort of two flavours. Well, I'd say two and a half flavours, really. You sometimes to get Fleet Street guys coming who are technically very good photographers, but sometimes don't understand the game. And you always tell who they are because they leave their kit out at half time and get it soaked with water. there are people, I would think, like me, who are sort of semi-pro, and some of those are quite good, some aren't. And you get people that are professional photographers who do a lot of hockey photography, and they are probably the best, I think. And again, we come back to AD, who I'm a great fan of, actually.
The game has changed a lot over the time you've been taking photographs.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
What have been the major challenges from your perspective in keeping up with those changes?
I think the speed of the game. And you always find, I turn up, but it's particularly noticeable in the Euro Hockey League, that somebody will do something you've never seen them done before. They've come up with some new thing, and you sort of are trying to anticipate what they're going to do, and they do something completely different. So that's quite interesting. I think and the speed of the game is incredible these days, absolutely. But fortunately, I've managed to keep up in terms of kit. One of the big challenges for any hockey photographer is shooting under floodlights and indoors. But over the years, the equipment we use has improved so that indoors and floodlights are not the challenge they used to be, which is excellent, really. I mean, when I first started, even a dull day would be a challenge, but not now. They've just gotten leaps and bounds. And over a relatively short space of time, really, over 10 years, really, of camera development. So, yes, I remember coming back from a tournament in Germany once where it had just been a bit overcast and very disappointed with the photographs, really very poor. But that's not a challenge now.
Indoor must be a challenge because of your positioning, because it's difficult to get to the point where you said you prefer to take your photographs outdoors.
Yeah.
Down low, close to the action, yes, as it were. You can't necessarily do that.
Yeah, and the other thing with indoors, of course, you're working with a much shorter court as well, so you can have players right on top of you and quite a way away within seconds. But... and, you know, like some halls are terrible. I mean, there's one particular one where I think if you struck a match, you would improve the light. and I always find Wembley very disappointing for a major, you know, venue, that the lighting there's so poor. But, you know, we get around it somehow.
Have you taken photographs at the ladies' hockey at Wembley? Or you...
Oh, yeah, no, I've done, yeah.
How was that?
I think the difference is, if you go and do an outdoor match on a reasonably good day, you could expect about three quarters of your photographs to be nicely exposed. If you go indoors, that would probably go down to about a third, because if you've got players moving really fast under poor light, then you're going to get, they won't be really, very well focused. But I think you'd need to choose your moment. I think set pieces are always very good indoors where people are not moving. Yeah. And, you know, there are other things you can do to try and improve your hit rate. But it's very noticeable just how the percentage of photographs in focus goes down quite a lot indoors.
And Wembley being an enclosed stadium, as it were, although with no roof.
Oh, I'm thinking about the...
Oh, you're thinking about the Empire Pool, Wembley.
Yeah, yeah.
Ah, right. Sorry.
I'm not that old.
That's why I asked if you were around taking photographs time.
No, but if you're looking at stadiums, of course, they sometimes throw up problems because it's... Not so much now, but in the early days of digital cameras, shadows cast by stands over pitches were a real problem, because you could find that the people who were in the shadow were virtually black and the people in the light were overexposed. Fortunately, the camera manufacturers have got techniques for getting around that now, and it's not the problem it used to be, but it really was quite a serious problem one time.
Is that by... looking at the photographs afterwards and doing some post...
No. The camera manufacturers have very cleverly come up with things that stop that from happening. So if there's a huge contrast in the picture, it will compensate for it. Mm. So that's made life a lot easier. One particular stadium I used to find very challenging was the Rotterdam Hockey Club stadium, where for some reason the light always seemed to be casting a very long shadow across the pitch, or halfway. But I had the same issue at the Hague for the World Cup, and that was... got two camera models on, and I didn't have anything like the same problem.
All the places you've travelled to, which was caused you the most difficulties in getting in, getting accreditation?
Well, in the early days, particularly European competitions, you could contact the organisers, you wouldn't have any reply. So you had to sort of take your life into your hands, book the tickets, book the hotel and turn up and hope something was going to happen. I had a rather interesting experience at one club in Spain, where I arrived to find that they had my accreditation, but I couldn't get in without an accreditation. So, so I found myself waiting outside until somebody came in that I knew and said, could you go and speak to someone in the press room so you can get me in here? But that's improved greatly. I think European competitions now, if you contact somebody and say, I'd like accreditation, it normally comes back. And of course, these days, I get the invitation sent to me automatically, so that's helpful.
Well, once you've established a reputation, it's much easier to do that, I think. Presumably, you paid all your own expenses going to all these places.
Yes, and it was a mixture of two things. Sometimes you had a promise of payment for your photographs, and sometimes it is speculative. And interestingly enough, you sometimes find that people come to you years later for photographs, which is quite handy. I think it was a local paper somewhere wanted a photograph of the Czech indoor goalkeeper in action, playing for his country, and I did have one. So, and I think that was about 5 years after I took the photograph, so it does happen sometimes.
Well, I suppose that's another benefit of having a reputation.
Yes, yes.
You know, if anybody's got it, people have it.
Yes, well, I think, I mean, that's one of the reasons. I've learnt a lot of lessons about domain names, and the reason why I chose hockeyimages.co.uk is because if you just Google that, you might come up with a name, even though you didn't know what the website address was. I know some people choose names, and I think, unfortunately, you will never get any hits with that name. Mm. So it's important to you choose the right domain names, I think.
And you've had half an eye on that sort of approach when you've stored your photographs, catalogued them.
Yeah.
Right from the beginning?
No, a bit chaotic at the beginning, but I think after about 2 or 3 years, I think I learned a lesson from that. So, I mean, God knows how many images I've got. It must run into tens, hundreds, thousands. But you know, if I know the year that it was in, I can generally find the match, and I've kept all the match reports from the game, so I need to reference the number of the player if I don't know them against the photographs, and generally it works. Generally.
Pretty organised filing system then.
Yeah. Yes, I say it was a bit chaotic at first, but it's okay. It's been okay, I think, for the last 10 years it's been okay. So.
And how did you marry doing all this activity with your full-time job?
Well, I've been very lucky, actually, because I retired from the police service at the age of 53, and I've never worked full-time since. I went to university for 3 years to a history degree and then worked for our local authority part-time. So that's given me the time. Local authority actually spotted they got a photographer on their staff, and that's almost become my full-time job with them as well. So I did a lot of work for them.
And what sort of photography is that?
Mostly social work. But like, for instance, when we had the elections last year, I've photographed all the councillors. I covered the election counts and that sort of thing. And when they have social events, I do those as well. Well, I was, but I'm not now. But that used to keep me quite well employed doing that. Fortunately, the chairman of the council was quite a keen amateur photographer himself. So he actually understood the value of having a photographer around rather than just giving an iPhone to somebody and hope for the best.
But presumably you started all this while you were still working for the police.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
You worked shift work for the police.
Yeah, well, I was very lucky because I was on our commercial investigation unit, which is an economic crime unit. And most of the time we worked office hours because, you know, we're dealing with people who worked in offices, obviously. So it did allow me a little bit of freedom. But it certainly, when I actually gave up work, it freed me up quite a lot. And you can see that by the number of events I started attending. Because I think I went from about one or two a year. One year, I think 2011, I think I went to about 7 or 8 of things abroad in the same year. So it went up quite remarkably.
Yeah, it's been an expensive year too.
Yeah, well, it's, probably somebody was paying. In the early days of operating the website, I had a very generous sponsor. Unfortunately, I lost them because they had financial problems during the crash, and they sort of had to cut back a bit. But they maintained, you know, I had a reasonable amount of money coming in from them, which enabled me to do all these things. Latterly, of course, it's been Mercian, who've also been quite generous, but not to the scale that it had been. It had been very generous indeed at one time.
Presumably you'd gone looking for a sponsor at some point. They come to me. Well, as hockey clubs have been looking for sponsors.
Interesting enough, I put something on my website to say that I wanted a sponsor, and I was very surprised. I got a response virtually immediately. And I was quite. They asked me how much I wanted. I plucked a figure out of the thin air, and they gave it to me. And that lasted for the best part of 3.5 years, I think. So that was good.
How did you get into radio?
Another long story. let's just pluck my way back into my early days. I used to have a friend who was a public address contractor, and we used to do gym cards and horse shows and things. And we turned up and put the gear up, and this chap was introduced to us as being the commentator, and he had to make an announcement, and for some reason he disappeared, and we never saw him again. I think he probably got cold feet. So somebody suggested I did it, and it sort of started a career of doing horse shows, gymkhanas, and point-to-point races, and all sorts of things. And actually, I've understudied some quite good commentators, Raymond Brooks Ward being one, and Hal Hudson another. So, you know, these are top guys. It sort of moved from there for me doing some freelancing work for BBC Radio Sussex. And this is a sad story. My moment of fame was I produced a half-hour programme about Cajun music for them, because there was a little bit of a Cajun music scene in Brighton at the time. And it was broadcast on the night of the Great Storm. so, as a rough estimate, I think probably 25 people heard it. And unfortunately, one of the things that happened, I never knew the story behind this, but Radio Sussex at one time was run virtually entirely by freelancers, and overnight they had a clear-out completely. People that were doing regular hour-long programmes just were out, and people that were doing the occasional thing, for some reason we all lost our work. But I had the training from Radio Sussex. That was a good thing. They'd actually put me on a course to show me how to do stuff. And of course, when I started the podcast with Talk Hockey Radio, that was extremely valuable information.
How did you start that?
Well, it all started, the crux of it was that I could see that Hockey Sport magazine was about to go out of business. And I'd become so used to going off to these international hockey events and getting accreditation, I could see that all coming to an end. So I was keen to stay reporting hockey. And I thought, I've got a skill here that other people might not have. So I did a bit of further research and started this monthly podcast, which is virtually a magazine programme containing interviews I've done with players. And I ran it for quite some time. But interestingly, as I mentioned about the photography becoming more important, I noticed that whereas visitors to my photos website were going up, people to the podcast site were going down. And it was proving difficult to do both. So I decided to opt for the photography website for preference. But it was great fun.
How long did you do the talk
for radio? I think probably about 6 or 7 years. But it was hard work. It really was, because I had to sort of get half an hour's worth of interviews every month, and then there was processing them and putting them online. Mm. Interesting enough, so this is a sort of mad thing I do, actually. I bought the website authoring programme a week before I was going to go online, with not a clue how to do it, and somehow I managed to get online with the podcast on the promised time. And I have to say, my web authoring skills have really gone through leaps and bounds during that time. I think I can actually do quite a good website now, but it was very crude in those days.
So who were the most interesting people to interview?
Oh, crikey. I mean, I did have certain people who could always be relied on to give you a good interview. Simon Mason was one. I mean, Simon was an absolute gem. I always found that Kate Walsh was a very good person to interview. One of the things, in fact, I was quite interested, actually. I had a conversation with somebody who worked for Sky Television who had done some hockey stuff. And he said to me, he said, you are very lucky doing what you're doing, because hockey players are just that so much better to interview. And they are. Very unusual to find a hockey player who can't give you a sensible answer to a question.
As compared with which sports?
I won't mention any sports, but no, but it is true, actually. And it's very, very rare. I can name a few internationals who I try to avoid interviewing because they are monosyllabic, but most of the guys are pretty good.
What about non-English a non-British or UK.
Absolutely. I used to interview foreign players. I had an arrangement with a similar website in Berlin called Radio Alex. And Radio Alex would interview people for me if they'd got representatives abroad. Claudia Klatt, who is quite a well-known hockey writer, has, for instance, interviewed English players playing in competitions in Argentina for me when she's been there. And likewise, I've done stuff for them in the UK or somewhere else where I've been. And some of the top German, Spanish, Dutch players are really very good when you interview them. They really are. They speak good English and they answer questions sensibly. And latterly, actually, I gave some of that work over to my wife to do, and she actually has quite enjoyed it. And she's found interviewing some of these German players very, very, very interesting, very satisfying.
Where haven't you been?
Well, that's interesting, actually, because I'm actually sort of ticking off places where I'm surprised. I mean, I've never been to Italy to do hockey, nor have I been to Sweden. But I've done most other big hockey nations. I've never done the United States of America because there's problems getting a work visa there. I'm damned if I'll queue up outside the American Embassy all day just to get permission to take photographs over there, which is one of the reasons I've never been. But furthest I've been is Malaysia for a Champions Trophy in Kuala Lumpur, which I think was in 2009. I might be wrong there. That's an interesting experience. I went over with Ken Wilson. Ken, of course, was working with the World Service, and that was quite helpful. And we actually swapped interviews at one stage. It's quite likely that World Service listened to one of my interviews, and I used one of his on my podcast. But, that was an interesting experience.
Did you get to India?
No. I've tried to avoid India, actually, because most hockey correspondents will tell you that it's not easy working out there. It's a mixture of tummy problems, and the security can sometimes be a bit over the top. I've heard problems of people even taking a sandwich into the media centre, you know. But it's not been a great loss to me. I mean, I really can't go to everything. I've gone to most things, but so in some ways I'd like to come to India, but it's one place I've sort of missed out.
Olympics?
Yes, 2012 Olympics. There's a little story there, which I'm sure your listeners might find interesting. One of the problems of being involved in a minority sport is you are a minority, and when you start quoting visitor numbers and the people who are actually following you online, you're talking about tiny figures compared with other sports. So I reckon my website was getting about 1,200 visitors a month, which is a drop in the ocean compared with most other sports. So when I applied for accreditation, I wasn't at all surprised I got turned down. I remember thinking to myself at the time that my friends are holding a party to which I'm not invited, which rather sort of upset me a bit. But then things took an interesting turn, because it's interesting how events going on in the world you don't think are anything to do with you, but it turns out they are. It was the time that the News of the World were in trouble with their phone hacking issues. And, of course, they decided to close the paper, and the powers that be decided that they would have to return all their accreditations. And they approached the editor of Push and said, "We have a photographer's accreditation, would you like to use it?" And he offered it to me. And that was 2 weeks before the games were due to start. So there I was, accredited to the Olympic Games, which was...
Which you made full use of.
Yes, I tried to be Mr. Cool, but I found it very difficult.
What was the most exciting thing about attending the Olympics?
Just being there. I mean, it's the most extraordinary, really. I remember walking with the editor of Push out from the accreditation centre, and he just turned to me and said, "Peter, with the Olympic Games, can you believe it?" And I said, "Not really, somebody needs to pinch me, you know." So it was a really good experience. I've actually said to people, if somebody gave me the choice between living another 5 years and missing the Olympics, I'd want to do the Olympics. It was just that amazing.
Absolutely.
So that's how I got involved in the Olympics, and that was a really amazing experience. I would not miss that for anything.
There's a common thread through a number of your stories of being in the right place at the right time, or just having a stroke of luck that took you a step forward. Would you consider yourself to have been lucky through your career?
Well, there's a saying in the police service that you make your own luck, and I think you've got to sort of make sure that you're in the right place at the right time. You just can't wait for things to sort of just happen just like that. I think you've got to make a little bit of an effort. So, yeah, I have been lucky. I agree with you there. But you've really got to manoeuvre yourself into a situation where luck comes your way.
And your talk radio, you said, lasted for...
About 7 years.
7 years.
Yeah, and then the website, I changed the name 2 years ago, 3 years ago, to Hockey in England, and dropped the podcast, and it was a purely news thing. I used to produce a weekly a newspaper online. And unfortunately, earlier this year when I got taken ill, I had to stop doing that because it was one of the initial problems I had with my eyesight when I was having trouble actually doing it. But we've sort of converted the website over into a combination of hockey and news about my illness, which is an interesting combination.
So it's become a blog.
Yeah, well, yeah, sort of. Yes. I know it's got some great fans. So
you've kept up with social media,
yes,
and adapted it and embraced it,
yes,
and used it to, yes, the full. Do you like this new world with where nothing is kept private, everything is out there?
Well, I've got mixed views about it. Certainly from my point of view, it's proved very good because, for instance, I'll give you an example. When I've taken photographs at the weekend, they go onto my Hockey Images website, and I usually put them on Twitter. And, you know, the fact they're there, and it usually has quite good results. I mean, the number of people who visit the Hockey Images website can vary wildly, but I have known, I think the record is about 1,500 visitors by Tuesday, which is quite extraordinary. On the other hand, I've actually known it to be under 100 by Tuesday. It very much depends on the game. So I hate to say this, but our ladies are not very good at supporting photographs online, and there are one or two clubs that are not particularly good, but some clubs are very good. Holcombe, as an example, you can always, if they're a match, you can always bet your bottom dollar that there'll be good following there.
Why do you think that is?
I really wish I knew the answer to that. I photographed a women's game up in the north of England, I think 2 or 3 years ago, and 3 years later, it was still the worst performing match I'd done. It had been overtaken by every match I'd photographed subsequently, and I really don't understand what went wrong there. But it's one of those things. If I knew the answer to that, I would be much wiser than I am.
And now, what are you doing now?
Well,
what are you able to do now?
Because I can't drive anymore, I rely on my wife. And there are hazards in photographing hockey. I'm having to be very careful. I'm trying, actually. I've got negotiations going with our local rugby club to do a little bit of photography for them. But I've had some really near escapes photographing hockey, and I think a ball to the head would just about finish me off at the moment. But, I mean, there's a German photographer who was at the European Cup in Manchester a few years ago. He was shooting a game involving Azerbaijan, and one of the players in temper hit the ball off the pitch. It must have missed his head by about a foot, and I mean that would have been a serious injury if it hit him. And unfortunately, players do that. They hit balls off the park in temper, or throw their sticks and all sorts of things. So. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's not deliberate. Poor old Tina Cullen caused me quite a serious injury once, for which she was very apologetic. But that wasn't her fault. It was just, you know, in the game. So, although being Tina, she came over and apologised.
And you said you're having trouble with your eyesight. How are you adapting your photography to cope with your
eyesight? Well, fortunately, there's two things on that. First of all, it's my left peripheral vision, and I'm right-eyed for
dominant eye.
That's the dominant eye. And I hadn't realised this, but it's likely that I'd had some problem overnight. The night before I went and photographed a match between East Grinstead and Wimbledon, sorry, East Grinstead and Surbiton, I wasn't feeling very well, and my wife very kindly drove me to the match. And the photographs I took are actually cracking. So perhaps there's something to be learnt from that. I don't know. They were good pictures. And that was under floodlights as well. So, yeah.
But have you got any enhancements on your laptop or your camera to enable you to see the pictures better?
No. One of the things I do in hospital, they teach you some scanning techniques. And would you believe, one of the things I did, one of the way I got around, I was gifted lots of it, is playing with Lego. Because, you know, the studs on the top.
Yeah.
And if you've got this particular problem with loss of peripheral vision, it's actually quite difficult to count the number of studs on the top. So you need to adapt your the way you do things, so you can say, oh, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and that's the one you want. And it worked really well. So I had every every little boy, you know, sons of friends of mine, give me Lego. And it worked really well. So, yeah, I still do have problems. One of the strange things is my spelling's gone a bit weird. I don't know why. I tend to spell things a bit phonetically, but fortunately my wife proofreads stuff for me, and I'm sometimes a bit embarrassed. But you know, it's sort of spelling father when you mean your dad with an R. You know, it's a bit like that. So,
oh, yeah. Spell check won't pick it up.
No, so I don't actually know what the cause of that is, but it's one of those strange things. I dare say I'll get used to it.
Peter, that's been absolutely wonderful hearing about all your background to what I knew about you as a photographer and a hockey reporter.
Thank you.
So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.